are listening to KBOO Portland.
Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m., KBOO makes everything metal. The Metal March returns again in 2025, featuring 10 hours of live bands and DJ sets from your favorite KBOO metal hosts. March 4th and support metal on KBOO. Text KBOO to 44321 or go to kboo.fm/give to donate and tune in to the Metal March Friday, March 14th at 8 p.m. through Saturday, March 15th at 6 a.m. Metal takes over the airwaves for the Metal March Metal Marathon, only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life, and this M1 International, RBG all day, baby.
On Hard Knock Radio.
Word up.
Check it out, yo.
Can I be the one to bring you joy?
What's up, y'all? This is Lettucey with Hard Knock Radio.
News, views, and hip-hop. I mine is Winston Bradley, a.k.a. Burning Spear, on Hard Knock Radio. Jai's real.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D, hanging out with you this afternoon. Last week, we had an incredible conversation with two of our comrades, two of our friends. No stranger to the airwaves, we're talking about Kali Ankuno from Cooperation Jackson and Sister Tandi Chemaringa, who we know from KPFK, our sister station, as well as Black Liberation Media. She's an author, journalist extraordinaire, and I think we're all familiar with Kali Ankuno's work in Jackson, Mississippi. They started a series, an education series called Build and Fight, and every Tuesday they have a round table and they really dig deep. We promised that we would pick up on that and share with you some of the discussions and breakdowns. Today we are going to play the first part of that series. So today you're going to hear the voices of Tandi Chemaringa as well as Kali Ankuno. So without further ado, let's turn it over to Sister Tandi Chemaringa and we'll come back and holler at you and let you know what's going down.
How y'all doing? Greetings. Good afternoon. Good evening. My name is Tandi Chemaringa. Special edition of Rootwork in conjunction with Cooperation Jackson. We are presenting the Build and Fight formula. The Build and Fight formula is both an argument and a proposed methodology on how to build eco-socialism from below, meaning through the self-organized activities and institutions of the working class and oppressed people. The principal architect of the Build and Fight formula is Brother Kali Ankuno, co-founder, co-executive director of Cooperation Jackson, which is based in Jackson, Mississippi. And Cooperation Jackson, of course, is committed to building a solidarity economy in Jackson, anchored by a network of cooperatives and worker-owned, democratically self-managed enterprises. Kali is no stranger to the platform, been here many times. We appreciate him. And now, Cooperation Jackson and we have entered into this partnership to bring this educational series. I need to stop talking so much and let our guest, Kali Ankuno, talk to you all about what is the Build and Fight formula of Cooperation Jackson. Thank you so much, Kali.
Always a pleasure, Tandi, to be here. Especially honored to be here tonight to start off this kind of educational series. We are planning on doing this. Was it the second Tuesday of every month? Mm-hmm. So please be advised. Let your friends know, your family know, your fellow cooperators and comrades, to join us, tune in. And as we go along, you know, we're going to be asking questions. We're going to be looking for feedback, pushback, because what we're going to go through, we make no pretension that it is the answer. We think it is part of an answer, and it helps to kind of maybe ground some of where we need to go, particularly in these perilous times.
Hold on, so you say you want some pushback? You want some smoke?
Oh yeah, we want the smoke. We want the smoke, you know, because look, it's not smoke for criticism's sake. Let me be clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We want to construct a new world.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to struggle with each other to get it right to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, correct theory should lead us to better practice.
Well,
and so we have to sharpen up our tools, and we have blind spots. You mm-hmm. know, we don't see or hear everything. It's not possible for one individual, one human being, one organization to do that. So that's why we want feedback to sharpen things up. That's how we've kind of come to this and arrived at this in a number of different things. And it's what you're going to, you know, hear from me is quite literally born as much failure as it has been the little bit of success that we've been able to garner.
Hmm.
Right. But it's learning from every mistake, learning the best possible anyway, learning hmm. from every mistake, learning from every failure, and trying to iterate at each point how to do better. Right. Yep. And doing intense criticism, self-criticism, and deep reflection on, you know, these are the things that we need to do. So this is what this is all based off. So, yeah, we definitely want and appreciate, you know, feedback. Doesn't mean we can get all to it, you know, respond to every point or be able to get to it, you know, at every, you know, immediate instance. But believe me, we take it all in to reflect, because this is part of the study practice. Study process that we have to be involved in. So definitely mm-hmm. hit us up, you know, and be on the lookout. And believe me, you know, the feedback we get will inform what we're going to be doing throughout the rest of the year, right? Mm-hmm. That is how we've been building this, and we've been working towards this, you know, for a minute. So we're going to try to keep this to an hour each time.
Okay.
And any of y'all heard me speak, sometimes that could be a challenge. My comrade Tanya is going to keep me on point as much as possible to get there. So today we're going to go through, you know, a few kind of early points to just kind of articulate a framework. And just I want folks to know, you know, kind of a basic outline is this intro is really trying to make a case, building an argument on why this particular set of practices, principles, and positions could lead to a revolutionary transformation.
Okay.
And why it's particularly, we argue, grounded in the history of this moment going forward, based upon the concrete conditions that we are facing, and based upon what people are already doing in the millions, right? Because we have to start, we argue, with where people are at, and then build upon that, but then try to fill in gaps, but also to make some arguments, right, that need to be made to push us all further along the road and ask, you know, get us to really think critically, why are we doing what we're doing? How could it be better? How could it lead and aggregate to us building and amassing more power, us ending certain social kind of relationships between particularly those of exploitation? How could it lead to all those different things? So,
okay, so what is the building fight formula?
So, yeah, so first to lay out the argument. You know, I want to just lay out off the top, like, this is premise on a notion that concretely, y'all, we don't have much time to enact the radical transformation that we need on this planet,
mm-hmm.
right? The capitalist system is killing this planet
mm-hmm.
and killing it rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are going to have to get rid of it before it gets rid of us. So I want to state that very clearly now. That's in some respects, many respects, most respects, easier said than done. But one of the critical shortcomings is that it's, you know, most people have gotten to the point, particularly over the last 40 years, where it's easier to envision the end of the world than it is to envision the end of capitalism. So we want to challenge that. Like up front, we want to challenge that and we have to challenge that.
Okay.
And the first kind of premise of the argument is that profound radical transformation is possible. Mm-hmm. And we want to back that up. You say, well, you know, prove it to me. We want to back that up with the critical analysis of the last like 15 years, but the last 5 years in particular. And to really highlight to folks that we've already lived through some profound transformation. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't necessarily sustained. It wasn't always consciously, you know, directed, meaning something that we in the masses agreed to and deliberately wanted to do that. It was somewhat spontaneous in relationship to the conditions. But we've seen a great deal of transformation. Now, what do I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'll go back to basically, you know, let's go back to 2011. Now, we can go back earlier, but I'm picking that as a kind of an arbitrary date. And one of the things people asked me to cite in this is some of the sources. And so one I'll mention here, I want folks to check out a book called If We Burn, right, which is an analysis of the 2010s and why all of the social revolution, the social upheavals, I should say, that occurred during that decade did not lead to a revolutionary transformation, and in many respects wind up installing the exact opposite. So if you look at Egypt, if you look at Syria, if you look at Tunisia, etc., you know, what happened with the Arab Spring, but then also if you bring forth, you know, what happened here in the United States was part of that same motion, right, from what happened in Tahrir Square to the indignados to Occupy, mm-hmm. right? That wind up leading, you can make a clear kind of case in following history, that wind up leading to the mass uprising that we saw, at least the form and character that it took, at the George Floyd rebellion that happened in 2020, but also the response, which is now kind of being borne out by Donald Trump and the rise of the MAGA movement. Check it out or check out some of their videos. And it's not necessarily that you have to agree with all of their analysis. I certainly don't, but it's an excellent kind of just documentation of moving through that decade till you see how these events pick up on each other, how folks are learning from each other, mm-hmm. you know, through the internet, through social media, right? Mm-hmm. Through the mass communications channels, how they accelerated time, how folks try to copy each other and what they were doing. You know, sometimes to great effect, you know, sometimes to ill effect, right? And then how the distortion of the media, I think he cites a good case in terms of Hong Kong and some of the protests that happened there trying to, you know, what they call the pro-democracy movement. We can argue if that's what it was or not. But, you know, in terms of the tactics that they employed, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things I think he does a good job of highlighting, both in his speeches and in the book, is how they, at a certain period of time, some of the key actors pivoted towards acting to elicit the greatest response from Western media mm-hmm. and abandoned what their people had already gravitated towards. And so they became more isolated and more small as a result. So a critical learning. But some of the tactics that they wind up developing there and how to avoid gas, you know, how to use gas masks, how to deal with some of that. We wind up incorporating some of the right. for rebellion here from folks making direct connections. Also folks making direct connections, you know, what happened like with Ferguson some years before from right. the Palestinians, right? To just bring right. this home in this methodology. Mm-hmm. But the critical piece I just want to cite real quick and then move through is that if we look at the profound the nature of how those uprisings transform society, polarized it, if nothing else. That is a profound transformation that we are living through. That means more space is actually open for us to experiment with, and we need to recognize that and be cognizant of that. Because mm-hmm. the ruling class forces, then and now, during this period, we need to be clear. They do not have concrete answers. This is not like the end of World War II, where they laid out the Bretton Woods, you know, program that wound up restructuring the world. It still structures a large part of the world that we live in. But that was based upon a clear vision, plan, right? And a clear understanding of they had control of the various organized forces that they could deploy to enact their program. They don't have that now. They're trying to institute that now. I'm just particularly citing the United States. Okay. And what they're trying to do with Project 2025. So they try to develop a level of cadre, but they don't, believe me, they don't have that all worked out. It's not all crystal clear, despite the chaos that Trump is trying, is unleashing on this society. Believe me, it ain't all worked out, right? And they are, you know, shooting darts everywhere, trying to see what sticks, trying to see what, right. what holds. But the difference between us and them is they have command over the state apparatus and a command over all the institutions and instrument of capital at their disposal to kind of shoot and fail and then pick up. Whereas we, there's more, you know, we have to more get it right kind of the first time in order for the transformation to take place. And we need a bunch of luck. Okay. So the critical piece is to understand that the space is open. And then there's a second part of this I want folks to kind of understand in terms of this argument around the possibility of you know, radical transformation being possible and potentially being on the agenda. Now, that is really going to depend upon us, and that's what we're going to get into. But I want folks to just go back to another episode in 2020, right, which is the beginning of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And this is one I tried to cite. I'll reiterate it here. You know, I'll go back to make a connection. And in 1992, you know, there was the Rio Summit. So the first big international climate change summit. Mm-hmm. And this occurred right after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, right? What most folks our age, you know, would call kind of the core of the socialist world, the socialist experiment. And it collapsed, leaving only China, you know, in the main, Cuba, Vietnam to a lesser degree, being kind of the last major kind of socialist projects, you know, operating under that vein. Well, we were told on the heels of this conference on the world scale that yes, climate change was a serious issue, but that the global economy was too complex for there to be any immediate, you know, answers to the crisis of carbon emissions, that it was too complicated. Fast forward to 2020 and the political necessity of grinding the global economy and global trade to a halt comes into play on the account of the COVID pandemic and dealing with something that they didn't quite understand, but knew that it was spreading like wildfire and they had no ability or no means at the early stages to fundamentally contain it without containing the flow of goods and of humans migrating or moving from place to place. Mm-hmm. So they restricted travel. They you know, basically said we're only going to allow essential services, the essential workers to come, the essential services to be open. Mm-hmm. And they basically ground global commerce to a halt. And guess what, y'all? Climate emissions, methane emissions dropped dramatically. Mm-hmm. So much so that we saw nature within the course of just 2 or 3 months, things rebounding, deer coming yep. back to the, yep. and coyotes and stuff, if, like in San Francisco and LA, you know, the animals were just coming back to, right. to spaces and places that they had long since vacated, right? On account of, you know, the human interaction there.
Right.
And guess what? They stopped this, right? And it wasn't for a long period of time. They stopped it and the world system didn't collapse. Right? The sky didn't fall, right? Mm-hmm. What we learn from that and what we have to deduce from that is radical transformation can take place if there is sufficient political will to do so. And for that very brief moment in time, I say it lasted about 6 months at max, there was sufficient political will. Now, there was a reactionary move against it, and we're still living in part with that reaction, right? Mm-hmm. But it demonstrated, and this is just one of many examples, it demonstrated that change can happen. It can happen in a profound way, and it can happen quickly. So mm-hmm. I want folks to just move from that and saying, if we what we witness in our own lifetimes should open up our imagination to envision the possibility of capitalism coming to an end, and it coming to an end on account of our organized activities and deliberate and consequential action. Yes, so sir. the critical thing moving from there is that we also then have to kind of deal with the next piece. We have to deal with kind of understanding some of the dynamics of the system itself. This is the second critical piece of this argument. And there's an article, again, citing a source, there's an article that myself, two of my comrades, Doug Norberg, Brian Drolet, we wrote in 2001 called Shifting Focus. And that's an underscoring argument here, right? And that was, you know, organizing for revolution, not for crisis avoidance. So I want everybody, if you haven't read that, to pick that up and look at it, because it's a subtext to much of what is going to be laid out throughout the course of this series. But I'll just summarize it in a couple of critical points here. For this one, I'm actually just going to read to make it quick. You know, y'all know I hate, for those of you know me, I hate doing that, and I hate PowerPoints, but I think it's important, right? So just start with this notion that we need to be clear that we need to be organizing, building for a revolution, not reform and crisis avoidance. Just as the piece said, this is fundamental. Now, what does that mean? Let's get into that. This is point two, right? The deepening crisis humanity faces is not rooted in human nature, as many will argue, right? Most of these arguments are based upon that, right? It's rooted in the economic and social systems humans have created and have, you know, developed and have evolved over time. The relationship that distinguishes the different types of economic systems that have structured most of human history is that between producers and their appropriations of surplus labor, which, you know, in its monetized form is surplus value. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm describing here is the evolution of class-based societies and how they've always had these kind of distinctions, right, between like landowner and serf, right, lord and peasant. And in our area, the dominant one being between employer and employee, boss and worker, the last version of this, the capitalist version, or is the former producer and appropriator of surplus value, right? Mm-hmm. Be clear about that, and that we need to be clear that we need to from a revolutionary perspective, that we need to reject all of these different forms of hierarchy and domination. That's a critical piece that we need to be clear upon. And where that leads is that understanding that dynamic and that relationship in the present era, you know, between capital and workers is another way of putting it, between employer and employee, between boss and worker, right? Between capital and workers in the main dominant piece. We need to be clear, and this is the third point, I think perhaps the most critical point for this particular era in purpose in this argument. What we've fundamentally been getting trapped by time and time again, I would argue basically since the Great Depression, is an argument primarily amongst the left over which form of capitalist rule we should be fighting for. Primarily because we don't believe the radical transformation I was speaking to earlier is on the immediate horizon or is possible. And so we wind up getting into a bunch of arguments about, can the capitalist system be reformed and can we help to usher in those reforms, right? Without critically, you know, making a distinction that number one, you know, and we're trying to put this in a global perspective. We want folks to understand very clearly, because then it helps to arm us in different ways in terms of fighting back. I want us to be clear about that. But there's this notion sometimes like that fascism is something different than what we understand as bourgeois democracy. And I'm not saying that they are the same, but they spring from the same root. And that root is capitalism.
Okay.
And capitalism will employ, based upon various conditions, right? It will employ different forms of governance in order to replicate itself and reproduce itself, right? And to protect itself in order for it to sustain. So there's some periods in time, right, that we're kind of coming to the tail end of that. Me and you, and probably a good chunk of our audience, you know, were born in the 1960s and 70s, and we caught the tail end of what one could call social democracy, right? Or like the welfare state, Now, the neoliberal order that they ushered in the 1980s has largely eviscerated most of that, not completely gone. I mean, they're working on that now. So when you hear this argument about the Republicans talking about they're going to destroy the Department of Education, or they're going to destroy ultimately, you know, Social Security, they're trying to complete that neoliberal revolution of privatizing everything. But just keep in mind that those things that they existed were still within the capitalist framework. Security and all those benefits, they still allowed the appropriation of our surplus value. They just tacked a certain amount and then distributed a certain amount, but it left the rulers in place. They didn't go anywhere. And the rulers never completely agreed with that program of being taxed, right, of being regulated, and they have fought back. And in this recent iteration, if you look at Trump or Orban or Modi, or you put it on the global scale, they fought back and repositioned themselves, at least in the current era, where they are now calling the shots and dismantling this old era. And they're ushering a new phase, kind of a neo-fascist phase. Well, neo-fascism is just another variant of the capitalist system. Now, I'm saying that because, you know, we need to get past fighting about with each other, particularly forces on the left, fighting with each other over which variant is going to be better than the other, because we've now, I think, safely can say within the last century and a half, lived through enough variations of this to know that if we don't kill it, that the other form, its opposite form, will just reemerge. So, like, if social democracy doesn't actually move towards the abolition of capital and is undermined, then it inevitably leaves the capitalist class and its enablers and supporters in place to build a reactionary movement that over 10, 20, 30 years will come back, right, and move itself and usher itself into power. And that is where we're at. So we have to figure out how to in this thing.
If you're just tuning in, you've been listening to the voice of Kali Nkuno along with Sister Tandi Chamaringa. Special edition of Hard Knock, we're carrying the education series that they started. It is called Build and Fight, the Build and Fight formula, ways in which we can all come together and face the challenges that are upon us at this present date. We're going to turn our attention back to them, let you know what's happening. Here's a little musical break. We'll come back and continue.
We shift the tide, let the power unwind. Unite the souls, leave oppression confined. Fascism crumbles when the masses unite. Echoes of justice piercing the night. Freedom's a battle, so we push through the fight. Shining the truth, setting darkness alight. Down with fascism, let's clear the way. Brighter tomorrows start today. Down with fascism, the chains won't hold. Stories of freedom boldly told.
Critical piece of what we first articulated, and this is the kind of the third point, is that starting with where folks are at, right? We have to end this deficit kind of mindset that we have and analysis that we have. And what do I mean by that?
Please.
We are constantly in this notion that we do not have enough forces. We do not have enough people. And if you mean enough people who are clearly in line with a particular politics, program, and worldview, you are absolutely correct. You're thinking about it just strictly in kind of a vanguardist way of moving social revolution, then you are correct. However, if you look at what people are engaged in that has the potential of transforming social relationships in a non-capitalist way, we see that there are millions of people just in the United States alone, but I would say even more outside, who are engaged in practices that if sufficiently coordinated, right, could lead to a radical transformation. And what I mean by radical transformation, like this is This is the piece we'll get into later, but they're within the cycle of capital. And if you could probably bring that one up, the one that says David Harvey, you know, to go to give people to understand Tundis a little bit. And this
cycle of capitalism, David Harvey.
That one. Mm-hmm. While Tandy is pulling that up, comrades, the without going in too deep, because we're already at the 30-minute mark.
Yes, sir.
We are trying to upend this particular valuation of surplus labor and surplus value. And we're going to go through a part of this so folks throughout this course understand this, but then also an argument of how we take initial concrete steps through the practices that are articulated in the solidarity economy as a basic means to integrate a way to move past this and to get to a spot wherein that we aim our collective endeavors towards the production of exchange values, use values, right? Not commodities. And that we now possess the technical means and capacity to move in ways that previous generations could only, you know, dream of. And this is the folks understand that the computing capacity, how capital wants to use it, as you listen to Peter Thiel, capital wants to use it to basically subject labor to total domination and control. There's another version of this wherein we could utilize all of this is kind of the wealth of human ingenuity and the accumulated kind of expression of humanity's intellectual growth. We could use it to transform society within our means to make our labors and endeavors easier with the context of appropriate technology. And what I mean by appropriate, things that are socially appropriate, that don't require a great deal of waste or excess production, too much extraction from the earth, and then things that are produced based upon need, not just based upon endless commodities that often just wind up in a trash heap somewhere because they don't produce the amount of profit that their producers want. And so they find of different ways to dispose of them or they do, you know, plant obsolescence. Instead of making things that could be durable for a generation, they make them to make sure that they fit a cycle of consumerism wherein things, you know, time out or break very calculated in intentionally.
My car, my iPhone, my laptop.
All these different things. They can make them a lot durable. They can make them a lot better. There are certain dynamics of the market where they choose not to. So this is part of the cycle of what we're going to upend. And what we're arguing for is that if we take what millions of people are already doing in the engagement of certain key solidarity practices, that we can create our own, you know, kind of value change that then upend this and move us towards production, towards values in our communities. And that we would argue we have enough critical mass mm-hmm. already that we could be major catalysts for this, for the development of eco-socialism from below. But it requires, and this is the piece, it requires a greater level of political clarity, intentionality, democratic coordination, mm-hmm. right from below, and concerted planning to eliminate excess waste, but to also meet the human need that mm-hmm. exists. Because believe me, right, there is no reason why in 2025, with all the excess production of just food alone, that there should be any human being on this planet who goes hungry.
Shouldn't be not one.
That is a problem not only of distribution, because some people will leave it at that. That's one dimension of the problem as it presently exists. But ultimately, we have to figure out how to socialize the means of production and put all of us in a democratic practice of being able to access common goods mm-hmm. so that we can meet our common needs from the collective pool of what humanity has produced. Mm-hmm. And the practice of the solidarity economy are the anchors to that. That is the argument. And then what we present as the formula are steps, a set of steps, you know, what we call the kind of the practices of position and the practices of maneuver. And the first part, we'll go through the practices of position, and that's taken from Gramsci, very intentionally and deliberately. So folks, Antonio Gramsci, Prison Notebooks, for those who've never read it or don't understand, you know, Want to know what the source is? Go back and look at that for this particular piece. And that's about how you deal with hegemonic and counter-hegemonic, dominant and non-dominant forces, and how the non-dominant forces can organize themselves to form a new both cultural view, worldview, and practice that distills kind of an anti-systemic practice to underscore, undercut, and ultimately destroy the dominant kind of perpetuation of ruling class ideology and practice. So that's what we are trying to aim with here, right, in these positions of maneuver, and what we are articulating with that. And then this is what the next couple of pieces will go over, is we're going to break down in detail, you know, using PowerPoint, all this different stuff. How do you practice mutual aid, and how does mutual aid and social reproduction lead to gathering enough information about the concrete needs that then we can then leverage that and connect it to doing a concerted level of planning around autonomous food production through a scaled up program of meeting all the different community small scale farms to large scale farms of independent farmers and producers, tie them together to meet particular needs. But then we also have to figure out how the mass of workers into appropriate basically the means of productive, turn that into to cooperative enterprises and link with each other to put all of the tools and all of the collective property into a pool that we could use to meet our collective needs. That's where the worker self-organization pieces come in, and we're going to talk about within that how we take the cooperative side, the trade union side, the worker center side of what is concretely going on now, how to better kind of link that together in a strategic way to utilize as much power. And we'll break all of those down individually in that way.
Let me jump in real quick. I don't want to take you off your focus too much, but this build and fight formula, practices of position, practices of maneuver, this is going to be done in conjunction and partnership with other organizations, correct?
Oh, absolutely. None of this of what we're talking about could be done by one organization.
Okay.
None of this, you know, and why we say we're starting, part of making the argument of starting what people are doing. Okay. Right, because we don't have, let's be clear, what the large part of this argument to underscore, we don't have the political parties of the 1930s or even the 1960s. Mm-hmm. That's not where we at. Okay. Right. And if we look at least in the United States, in most of so-called Western world, is profoundly different in the global South, where in the global South, you still have, you know, organized factions of the left in terms of political forces there. Particularly in Latin America, who can and are moving on things. And we'll talk about how that kind of relates. But in our kind of U.S. context, you know, we don't have political parties that can move tens of thousands, if not millions of people into a concerted program. Mm-hmm. But what we do have, right, we have millions of people who are involved in projects where they're doing, you know, farming in their communities of various scales. Right. It's just not coordinated, right? It's not being planned to meet the basic caloric needs of our community. So most of it's done, you know, to meet kind of personal needs or small scale needs. And I would say, like, even in Cooperation Jackson, we're doing, you know, trying to do a level of scale to reach about 25,000 people. But Jackson is a city of 160,000 to 180,000 people, give or take. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to figure out, coordinate with other folks in Jackson, how to scale up production. And that doesn't mean Cooperation Jackson is going to do this. Our role is to just be a catalyst to say, hey, if we do this, this is what it could lead to. Okay. Right? We can move from food security ultimately towards an element or aspect of food sovereignty, at least on the local level, so that we can meet the caloric needs and we could end food as a weapon. But then more importantly, right, we could free up more people's time, right, from having to pursue the endeavor of wage labor, wage employment, right, so that they have more free time to do more of what they want to do, and you can kind of reduce folks' bills. Now, there's a system that has to go on. That's what this formula is saying, that these practices have to be coordinated in conjunction with each other. Otherwise, they're just kind of isolated endeavors that may make some things of our lives a little bit easier. But if we don't deal, per se, with the broader dimension of, like, land decommodification and the collective stewardship of land, which is an anchor of where we need to go for towards food sovereignty. If we don't deal with that and deal with kind of collective housing solutions, right? You're still leaving folks subject to all the predatory things of the market and the need for ways to meet the market kind of necessity that's been structured within the capitalist system. So it's trying to be comprehensive within the framework of what people are already doing. And what I mean by ending in this deficit, you know, piece is that if you take the whole of all the different organizing efforts that are taking place just in the United States alone, like in the housing arena, right, for health and reproductive justice, right, for workers' rights, if you aggregate that all together, there's a lot of people working on a lot of stuff.
Yes.
A lot of people, millions of people working on stuff every single day. Mm-hmm. But because we don't have a framework to unite it coherently, right, and one that's co-constructed, right? And so this is an argument for co-construction, not one that just kind of imposed something from above, because we've seen, you know, time and time again, that has its advantages, but more disadvantages than advantages. So a co-construction of how do we get people to plan and coordinate with each other to aggregate power, right, but to also transform the system by getting out of those, you know, that cycle of MCM, right, money, commodities, money, that is premised, the capitalist society is premised on, which forces us all to be, you know, chasers of a wage, or another old way of saying to be wage slaves and be dependent upon that to earn our livelihood. It's either that, if we don't build an alternative, be thrown out in the streets or go hungry. Right. And remember, this is in a society which produces an overabundance, or world system that produces an overabundance of all the material goods that are necessary for all of humanity to live well.
I'm seeing a couple of questions in the chat. Michael Nugent asks, what about these arguments about techno-feudalism, or that capitalism is in terminal decline? I've been hearing that for 40 years. Are these changes legit, and do they change how we fight? Who the revolutionary subject is? Your thoughts?
Great question. Great question. And I've been thinking about doing a particular set of series just upon this from my vantage point. And let me riff off a comment that you just said, Tandy, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you've been hearing that for 40 years. Well, it takes that long for the system to actually, if not longer, to collapse.
Well,
right? And so if we go into some of the works of, say, again, citing sources I want people to read, and you don't have to agree with all of it, but if you look at some of the works of like Emmanuel Wallerstein or Undergrunder Frank in their, you know, particular assessment of the capitalist world system, we see that things take roughly 50 to 60 years to sink in and transform.
Okay.
So if you're thinking about it within, and this is part of a level of consciousness that we have to kind of ascribe to. So within the context of our own lifetime, you might dismiss certain arguments, but if you look at it in the context of several generations, you'll see that yes, this system is in a very terminal decline. And I would argue that techno-feudalism is not just a symptom of the decline, right? But it is something that is going to hasten and speed it up. And for me, I had been arguing before, and for folks who, again, to cite a source, if it hasn't been put in the chat, one of the main framers, I think the lead framer of this techno-feudalism argument is Yanis Varoufakis. Look up his book on techno-feudalism. I can't remember the exact title.
Varoufakis, is that the brother from Greece?
That's a brother from Greece, a comrade from Greece, who, you know, who...
Austerity movement?
The post-austerity movement. He was in the Syriza government, which, in my view, wind up making a classic portrayal of the people, leading them down a dead-end path. Part of what I was arguing against around, you know, whether what type of concessions we can get, you know, from capital rather than making a clean, or some would argue, kind of a dirty break. And going it alone, at least in regards to them switching out of being part of the EU and going back into kind of their own currency or their own transactional relationships, and then using that to foster the dynamic growth of the solidarity economy, because Greece had that at the time. And then one definitely emerged in the midst of their crisis following the financial collapse of 2007, 2008, 2009. That there was a profound social movement that they wind up basically kind of betraying and gave space to the current right government, which is now in place in Greece. But I think, you know, this move, this terminal decline, has led to the rise of all of these neo-fascist forces, or these right-wing authoritarian forces, you know, the likes of, again, I'll cite Modi in India, you know, Erdogan in Turkey, you know, we can go on, Orban in Hungary, Malay in Argentina, and the list goes on. And unfortunately, we'll probably have, you know, a right-wing government in Germany and in France soon. As a result,
are these changes legit, and do they change how we fight, who the revolutionary subject is?
Legit, if the answer is the system moving in that direction, I would say, if that's what is meant by legit, clearly that is what's going on. I mean, we can just look at what Trump has enabled in terms of the cabinet and like what he's done with Doge and Elon Musk, basically kind of making him his co-president. But it's not just him, right? It's all the techno-feudal lords, you know, which have made a very clear and conscious decision to ally themselves with Trump and the MAGA movement on a very deliberate nature, and why they are very much invested in a deep race for or over AI, artificial intelligence, and this global competition to who's going to get there first from between themselves, being the United States and China, and why J.D. Vance in real time is over in Europe now threatening the Europeans that they either get on board with the United States and open up all of their markets towards the U.S. domination of AI and work with them, or they're going to be punished. Now, you don't normally talk to your friends like that.
No, you don't. You're not supposed to.
And so, you know, that speaks to a different time, a different order, that is not just about Trump's personality. Folks need to understand that. Mm-hmm. Right. This is about capital's deep restructuring and trying to get to a particular place, right, so that the West maintains its hegemonic control over the earth, over its peoples and all of its resources, so that a certain group of people continue to benefit at the expense of others. So that race is still going on. That is why Elon Musk, who, you know, who's supposed to be running part of the government now, is trying to issue a hostile takeover of OpenAI, right? Put these things in perspective to understand what a techno-feudalism piece in the argument of why it's legit. Does that change how we fight? I would argue, and we'll go through it, in some ways profoundly, yes, and in some ways, at least in terms of what we're articulating, no, right? Now, what we need to be clear on, I think, in terms of kind of like what principles and program, the piece that we'll get to where we talk specifically about social digital infrastructure, that deals with how we in community production within this formula, that deals with how we are arguing that we should be engaging in these kind of new technologies, but not engaging them on capital's term, but to the greatest extent possible, appropriating them at the scale that they could be utilized through open source to create our own means. And that is why, just to cite and then get back to this, that is why I want folks to go back and look at I'm forgetting the name, Deep Seek, whatever, the AI piece that China put together. That was a profound move, y'all. And I'm not saying that to like praise, you know, China, but that was a pretty concerted move that opened up a tremendous amount of space. And what they fundamentally did by making that open source, they made it so that folks in Nigeria can take some elements of their code and work on it without having to deal with the proprietorship or ownership. Or me and you can learn how to code and be involved in that and help this technology grow and function and ensure it actually functions to serve human need and not further, right, the private appropriation, capture, and social control that the capitalists are aiming towards. Very explicitly. If you don't believe me, listen to what Peter Thiel said about 2 weeks ago.
So this can be done through our labor unions, right? Or is that idealistic?
It's going to have to be done through them and beyond them, right? And to be clear, like, we need those institutions to, you know, be transformed from the inside, and we need them in particular to jettison, you know, the agreements that have confined them and that folks kind of adhere to you know, for the greater part of what, about 70 years. And what am I specifically relating to in terms of the United States, right? Like we have fundamentally, and I've been part of the trade union movement, still part of the trade union movement, mm-hmm. but we've kind of hamstrung ourselves in accepting the National Labor Relations Act in this framework that comes out of it, right? Which keeps us from acting in politically or acting in solidarity in a number of fundamental ways. And then how that's supported by the right to work regime structured by the Taft-Hartley law. We have to go beyond that. And we should have been going beyond that a long time ago, right? And so we now have to, you know, be very clear that to the degree that the MAGA movement is very in intentional about destroying all of the liberal bourgeois protections that supposedly are enshrined in the Constitution, we ain't got no need to uphold it either, right? This is where our mind and space has to open up and seize the opportunities that exist amongst the contradictions that they are creating. So if they're not going to necessarily play by the rules, there's no reason why we should either.
We're going to end this right here. You've been listening to a special edition of Hard Knock Radio done in conjunction with our partners. We're talking about Kali and Kuno from Cooperation Jackson in Mississippi and Sister Tandi Chemaringa from Black Liberation Media and also KPFK, our sister station down in LA. They have started an education series called Build and Fight, the Build and Fight formula, and we agreed to help amplify these conversations, get the word out to you all. So we appreciate you all listening. We'll be back tomorrow on Hard Knock Radio. Peace out, y'all. Da, 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 da.
Time's running out for the dream they chase. Longing for a past built on fear and hate. Whispers of glory, but the truth won't fade. The good old days weren't good for everyone's fate. Time's running out. America won't be great for those who hate our souls. Built on our blood, but they lost control. Now they weep for a past soaked in shame. But history will let them play that game. Ain't gonna be no good old days. Time's running out. Ain't gonna be no good old days. Time's running out. Time won't go back no matter how much they try. History's watching, you can't live in a lie. Hate-filled people ain't gonna live forever. Their days are numbered, we're counting together. Together, ain't it gonna be no good old days? Time's running out. Ooh, oh, hey. Ain't gonna be no good old days. Yeah. Ooh. Time's running out. You ain't gonna live no more, no more. You ain't gonna live no more. Paybacks are coming, your debt is due. No place to run, there's no saving you. Ain't gonna be no good old days. Time's running out. Thank you.
The cries they ignored now shake the sky. The thrones they sat on are running dry.
With the group Chicago, and you're listening to KBOO FM.
This is Bird Note. A flash of glittering dark blue cuts through the gray of late February as a male tree swallow glides low over a cattail marsh. The tree swallow's liquid notes hint at spring's approach. Where a broad green pasture meets the forest edge, there is a second, even brighter flash of blue. A male bluebird alights on a fence post. The intense blue of its back glints in the welcome sunlight of late winter. Tree swallows, and all three North American bluebird species, are among the earliest northbound migrants to arrive, heralding spring a month before the equinox. Both species will nest only in cavities, such as old woodpecker holes or man-made nest boxes. The supply of such specialized nest sites is limited. Competition is intense. By arriving so early, tree swallows and bluebirds improve their chances of finding unoccupied cavities, and they may fiercely guard a nest site until April, before actually nesting. Both species benefit greatly from nest box programs, but it's crucial to put up only nest boxes with very specific hole sizes that encourage these flashy blue migrants, but deter non-native starlings and house sparrows. To learn about how to provide just the right home for tree swallows and bluebirds, come to our website, birdnote.org.
Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Ya no pienso mantener este cariño. Mientras me parto el alma, te das la vida de placeres, y yo en mis desesperos.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934.